Ecological Forestry, Origins and Principles by Tony D'Amato. Editor's Note from Liz Thompson. As soon as Tony D'Amato arrived at the University of Vermont in 2015, I knew he would quickly become a valuable partner in the state's and the region's forest conservation community. Since then, I've had the distinct pleasure of collaborating with him on several projects, including the publication of Restoring Old Growth Characteristics. We've served together on graduate studies committees, where he is always the kindest and most encouraging mentor. He carries with him a deep conviction that there is something for everyone in the practice of silviculture, that we can have wildlands, ecologically managed forests, and some places that are more intensively managed for particular purposes. And he literally, with others, wrote the book on ecological forestry, or Ecological Silviculture, as it's titled. This essay gives us a good, solid look at that topic, its origins, its nuances, and its practices.
I always start my silviculture course by sharing with my students that we're all a time capsule of when we went to forestry school. Although foresters are lifelong learners, the context for which topics are discussed and applied in the classroom reflect the social, economic, and ecological dynamics of the period, whether that be today's emphasis on adaptation to changing climate and disturbance regimes, or historic focus on sustaining wood production for a growing nation. My time capsule was packed and sealed in the late 1990s, a period when ecological forestry was being popularized across North America. I was a forestry student at the University of Maine, and was fortunate to have a visionary on this topic as my silviculture professor, Dr. Bob Seymour. At the time, there was a tension around ecological forestry in the classroom and across the profession. Some viewed it as a threat to the profession and our ability to effectively produce wood. Others, like me, viewed it as a revelation that greatly broadened the palette from which the art of silviculture could draw. As evidenced by this issue from the ground up, interest in and applications of ecological forestry have only continued to grow since that time. But it's worth exploring exactly where these newer colors in a forester's palette came from and how they're applied today. When I was first introduced to ecological forestry, it was often referred to as new forestry because it represented models of stewardship that stood in stark contrast to the older wood production systems emphasized by multiple-use sustained yield principles. This new forestry was an outgrowth of the timber wars of the late 1980s in the Pacific Northwest, which pitted old-growth conservation against timber production. Presented as a middle ground, new forestry was advanced by Dr. Jerry Franklin and his colleagues at the H.J. Andrews Experimental Forest in Oregon. It was a management approach that integrated stand-level and landscape-level measures, retention of biological legacies, extended harvest rotations, and forest zoning, for example, to support diverse species and values from forests, not just to maximize wood production. Although anything but radical today, this emphasis on the ecosystem over production was a completely new way of thinking about our relationship with the forest. Or was it? To test how novel this new forestry was, we might first look to the European forestry literature. It's a long-held tradition of American forestry to celebrate its European roots. It's hard to find an American forester or forestry instructor who doesn't get jazzed up talking about early Euro influences, including concepts like Famelschlag, as discussed in this issue. Nevertheless, the idea of putting ecosystem over extractive use is largely absent from these European roots, mainly because they sprouted from a socioeconomic context of preventing wood shortage. Consequently, the roots of European forestry are firmly planted in top-down and command-and-control approaches for sustaining a wood crop, with economic expediency a guiding tenet. Such a mindset was carried forward into the fledgling United States forestry profession in the early 20th century, which recognized the need to adapt European ideas to American conditions, but also kept the production of wood crops and highest returns from the land as the primary goals of forestry. Our long-standing emphasis on these European roots has resulted in little acknowledgement of the models of ecological forestry that did exist in North America, long before the founding of our first forestry schools. In particular, the idea of supporting the full ecosystem with one's stewardship and honoring the material and immaterial gifts provided by the forest through multi-generational care is central to indigenous culture. In contrast to the European models adopted by early U.S. foresters to maximize yield and economic return, forest stewardship approaches developed by tribal nations, such as those advanced by the Menominee tribe during the 1850s in present-day Wisconsin, tied the harvest of wood and the health of the forest to the health and sovereignty of their community. This acknowledgement of one's connection to all living beings provides a far different construct for practicing forestry, a commitment to reciprocity and constant reflection on what we are leaving for the forest and what we're leaving to support future generations. It took over a century for U.S. forestry training to catch on and center this worldview. There was an early outlier in Petersham, Massachusetts that got the part about listening to the forest. The Harvard Forest, like other early forestry schools, started by importing European ideas into the forests of north central Massachusetts at its founding in 1907. After a few decades of futility, fighting the natural tendency of the forest by indiscriminately promoting conifer plantations, Dr. Richard Fisher and his students, Al Klein and Stephen Spur, began to recognize that the best course for silviculture was to follow nature as far as possible. This management philosophy was solidified by frequent visits to remnant old-growth forests in southwestern New Hampshire. These forests served as living classrooms, instilling many lessons on how site conditions and disturbances shape natural forest dynamics over space and time. Spur and Klein translated these lessons into recommendations that used natural succession and disturbance regimes to guide silvicultural decisions in a 1942 publication that represents the first usage of the term ecological forestry in the North American forestry literature. Like the teachings of indigenous stewards, these ideas didn't catch on at the time. It wasn't until new forestry emerged four decades later that ecological models of stewardship finally got traction in the broader forestry community. Over the past few decades, ecological forestry has shifted from the fringes of the profession to the mainstream. This shift highlights the consistency of ecological forestry with broader calls to sustain the full range of ecosystem services and species for managed forests, with associated policies, landowner incentives, and forest product certification programs motivating movement towards more ecological practices. It also reflects the mainstreaming of these ideas in forestry education and professional training, which has been facilitated by greater clarity over what ecological forestry is, its differences from other models of forestry, and its translation to a broad range of ecosystems and contexts, not just the Douglas fir forest that served as the archetypes of new forestry in the early 1990s. The broader translation and formalization of ecological forestry has largely been guided by Dr. Brian Palak of the USDA Forest Service, whose definition I'm admittedly biased towards. A management approach that applies an understanding of the structure, function, and dynamics of natural forest ecosystems to achieve integrated environmental, economic, and social outcomes. This approach builds on the foundations of traditional forestry and ecology and is guided by four core principles that have allowed for widespread application in diverse ecosystem types and regions around the globe. Principle 1, continuity, 2, complexity diversity, 3, timing, and 4, context. Continuity acknowledges the importance of biological legacies in supporting species and processes following disturbance, and stipulates that management actions maintain continuity in forest structure, function, and biota between pre- and post-harvest ecosystems. Complexity diversity reflects the need to create and maintain structural complexity and species diversity through all silvicultural inventions, recognizing the importance of niche-rich, stand-level, and landscape-level conditions in supporting diverse biota and pathways for ecosystem resilience. Timing uses ecological rather than human time frames to inform management decisions, favoring timescales required to develop large tree habitats or support dispersal of slow-moving or sensitive species instead of maximizing net present value. Finally, context underscores the importance of considering the structure and function of landscapes from both an ecological and socioeconomic perspective when applying forest management decisions. This includes designating wildland reserves and expanding applications of ecological forestry across a range of ownership types. Ecological forestry is not a monolith. Its application, like any other approach, needs to be tied to an understanding of local ecosystems and the communities that depend upon them. One guiding framework is to emulate elements of the prevailing disturbance regime for a region, ranging from frequent small gaps disturbances common in many of our northern hardwood forests to the infrequent severe fires characteristic of the Douglas fir forests of the Pacific Northwest. This in turn affects how the core principles are applied to the structures retained, tree ages and species diversity supported, time frames for harvest intervals, and the distribution of management across the landscape. In short, ecological forestry is guided by what is appropriate for the forest as opposed to what is most efficient for growing trees to commercial size. It is also applied within the context of landowner goals, leading to a spectrum of opportunities and outcomes that reflect the marriage of its principles with the ecological and human values of diverse forest ownerships. Despite the compatibility of ecological forestry with many contemporary ecological, cultural, and social values and objectives, it currently contributes the least to meeting society's wood consumption. Instead, almost 50% of global wood consumption is met by plantation monocultures, nearly all of which exist outside of New England. Although plantations certainly are an important tool for conservation by lessening the demands placed on other forests and allowing for more wildlands, they leave little for the forest beyond the ability to grow another wood crop. At the same time, much of the wood production in our region deviates from ecological forestry principles, with recent assessments classifying approximately 50% of harvests occurring in New England and New York as not actually applying sustainable silvicultural practices, or any silvicultural at all. Ironically, many of the landscapes and ownerships where sound silviculture, and in some cases ecological forestry is practiced, for example public lands, are those where the greatest levels of public opposition exist to any form of forest management. How can we proclaim to care for the wonders and complexity of forests, yet continue to get most of our wood from places where forests are treated like agricultural crops or resources to be mined? This conundrum sadly reflects a key disconnect in the acceptance of ecological forestry today. While the forestry profession has embraced many of ecological forestry's ideas and principles, broader society has not. This conundrum sadly reflects a key disconnect in the acceptance of ecological forestry today. While the forestry profession has embraced many of ecological forestry's ideas and principles, broader society has not, particularly in relation to its consumerism. Leaving something for the forest, the tax to the land, often means we need to be willing to pay more for wood. Let's call it an ecological premium. Today we can get wood cheaply from far-off places, which separates us from the impacts of our consumption and serves as a blind endorsement of any form of forestry as long as it's affordable and not in one's backyard, or the backyard of one's second or third home. If we truly want to honor the many gifts forests provide us, there needs to be a recalibration of how we supply our wood, with local ecological forestry practices being a primary mode. That recalibration is anything but simple, but my hope is that the examples of ecological forestry being practiced across our region will help to inspire more individuals and communities to get involved with their forest in respectful and reciprocal ways. In other words, my hope is that more will adopt ecological forestry and the powerful model it provides to connect with the forest. There are plenty of time capsules just waiting to be unpacked.